I'm here on the job site with Dale, who's a framing contractor.
Hey, good morning.
Dale traded up to Geico Commercial Auto Insurance for all his business vehicles. We're here where he needs us most.
Yep, they sure are.
We make it easy for him to save on all his insurance needs, all in one place, with coverage that fits his business and bottom line. Oh, I shouldn't have looked down.
It's all right.
We're so far up here.
Look at me. Take a deep breath.
No, I'm good. So good.
Get a commercial auto insurance quote today at Geico.com and see how much you could save. Get more with Geico.
I'm Chris Hewitt, and welcome to a very special edition of the Empire Podcast in association with our friends at Warner Brothers. You know, over the last 25 years or so, there has been one directing Paul Anderson who has bestrode cinema like a colossus. No, not that guy, not the guy who directed Event Horizon, not Paul W.S. Anderson. I'm talking, of course, about Paul Thomas Anderson, PTA himself, the director of Magnolia and Punch Drunk Love and There Will Be Blood and Hard Eight and The Master and Licorice Pizza and Inherent Vice and One Battle After Another and, of course, Boogie Nights, which has now been finally remastered in 4K UHD and is available for you to buy right now. And that momentous event has meant that I have now corralled three colleagues of such lethal cunning together in this pod booth to chat all things Boogie Nights and PTA for the next 45 minutes or so. We're going to have a simply capital time. The big, bright, shining stars I have assembled are, of course, James Thomas Dyer.
Hello, Chris.
Alex Thomas Godfrey.
Good evening.
Helen Thomas O'Hara?
I guess. Hello.
Wow, that's a weird middle name.
You know, I like to mix it up.
But there you go. And of course, it's me, Chris Thomas. Actually, that is my middle name.
That literally is.
Genuinely, it's my
you
middle name.
You just stumbled into that.
Chris Thomas. I am a CTA because I'm Ambrose. Yeah. And my mother's maiden name was and our dog growing up was so if any fraudsters out there would like to would like to guess my password, that'll help you. That'll help you along the way. So there you go. So Boogie Nights. Let's start with Boogie Nights and get a kind of overview of PTA and this wonderful, wonderful career. We have something in Empire Magazine called Classic Scene. It's at the back of the magazine, and it is where we ask filmmakers and actors to choose one of their favorite movie scenes of all time and tell us why they love it. And no word of a lie, only one scene has been chosen by multiple people. And that scene is the firecracker scene featuring Alfred Molina from Boogie Nights. Yeah. And one of the people who chose it as well was Mark Wahlberg, who's in the scene. And I said, Mark, you can't choose a scene that you're in. But I can understand why you would, because it's an amazing scene. But I think that shows just what an impact and what a legacy Boogie Nights has had since it dropped in 1997. Alex, I know you love Boogie Nights.
I do. And by the way, that scene, I mean, even out of context, it's got everything you could want from cinema in that scene. It's so funny. It's so wild. It's so unhinged. The energy of it.
It's so intense as well.
It's nothing quite. It's stressful and scary and funny at the same time. Alfred Molina is just, I mean, the guy, the character's supposed to be up for like 3 days and he's just an absolute maniac. Mark Wahlberg's actually, there's that amazing shot of him where he's clearly just having this massive existential meltdown on camera. He's Mark Wahlberg is so, we'll get into it, but he's so brilliant in this film.
Yeah.
And there are many levels to the performance. I mean, he basically plays at least two characters in this film. You know, he starts off as this innocent, wide-eyed suburban kid who's obviously got, he's in demand for his
His extensive talents.
And he knows that. And, you know, he's getting paid to do things with it. But also, he's just...
Not unlike podcasters.
A little unlike podcasters.
Do you think?
Yeah.
All right.
But he's still a kid living at home with his parents and just wants, you know, he's got dreams of getting out of there. He doesn't know what he wants to be. He says he's going to be a big, bright, shining star. He doesn't quite know where that's going to take him. But, you know, after like an hour and a half into the film, once the cocaine comes into it, and he plays this complete obnoxious arrogant, like wannabe rock star, actual porn star. He's very convincing at both these types of people. And it's pretty smooth transition from one into the other. But anyway, I digress. That scene is amazing. I mean, it's so funny. It's so stressful. It's so scary. There's genuine emotion in it. There's real heart in it.
It's got Tom Jane in it. I mean, any scene that has Tom Jane in it, I'm just on
probably the
on board.
First time I was aware of Thomas Jane as well, really? I think. Yeah, had you seen him before this?
When was Deep Blue Sea?
Yeah, I was going to say.
No, Deep Blue Sea was after Boogie Nights.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
And Punisher was after.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Many years. Yeah.
So, yeah, probably was the first time. You know, the firecrackers were not scripted. That was the whole. Because Joe Chan is Anderson's friend, and he'd been doing it at a party. And so they just did it on the day. And it kind of it makes that scene. It really does. It's fantastic because it keeps you on edge as it does the characters all the way through.
So much.
Yeah, I think Mark Wahlberg's reactions to those firecrackers were real.
Yeah, I don't doubt it.
I'm sure lots of trivia will come up. But talking of which, Paul Thomas Anderson wanted Sean Penn to play the Avril Lavigne role.
Yeah.
Offered it to him. He said no. Obviously, he would work with him a couple of times later, more recently. And then John Turturro was also up for that role. You can see what Sean Penn and John Turturro would have done with that role.
But it would have been very
different. Would have been amazing. But I think there's a surprise in that Alfred Molina did it. And obviously he's having so much fun with it. But if this is how we're going to start talking about the film, I think the interesting thing is the whole film is a string of amazing films. Boogie Nights, like Goodfellas, and it's very obviously heavily influenced by Goodfellas, but it makes the grade. It's just as effective in being, you know, Goodfellas was sort of designed as to feel almost like a 2.5 hour trailer. You know, it's like it's got this montage feel where every scene bleeds into the next. And Boogie Nights is kind of the same. There's not one scene in there that just feels like it's in there just to get things moving or just to get onto the next scene. Every single scene
feels character driven.
Yeah. And it's so entertaining. And so
rich and vital as well. And the filmmaking is so energetic. And this was the film that really, really put PTA on the map. Because Hard Eight is, of course, his debut. But I don't think you could look really at Hard Eight. And, you know, if you said to me when I saw Hard Eight for the first time, that the director of this is going to be one of the great American directors and maybe the greatest American director of the next 25 years, I'd have gone, no. I'm not so sure. But Boogie Nights, you can absolutely see it. And Hell's Bells, do you have the touch? Do you have the power when it comes to this movie?
I love this movie. I don't know if that means I have the touch or the power recording it. I think it's brilliantly, brilliantly put together. Like you say, it's the character arc, particularly for Eddie/Dirk, but really the way everyone is given these moments of grace and humanity and humor and heart, I think is kind of wonderful. I feel like he fell in love with his characters during the film because, you know, there are moments of, it's almost a super happy ending for many of them in a way that you might not have expected 2/3 of the way through.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there is a sort of, I don't want to call it pulling its punches because that's not how it feels. It feels more like he just loved them and wanted them to find a way through the sort of the dark years and the cocaine addiction in some cases and give you a sense of hope at the end of the movie that kind of they're all going to get through. Okay, I'm not saying everybody's going to get through unscathed, but it feels like there's at least hope. And I think that's not necessarily something that every film in 1997 would have done in a subject like this. It could have been very, very bleak at the end. And actually, it feels like it's going to be at one point. There's that point, you know, sort of really 20 minutes, 25 minutes before the end where you're like, ooh.
Yeah, this is all going to hell in a handbasket.
Well, the New Year's Eve party that signals
the move from
Bill Macy. That sequence is so astonishing.
Yeah.
You know, it's one of those scenes I rewatch every now and again because I think that is just, it's extraordinary.
It wrong foots you, doesn't it? Because until that point, the kind of recurring motif of his wife sleeping with other people has been humorous.
Yeah.
And it's funny until it's not. And that's a really bleak kind of full stop at the end of that sequence. And it hits hard.
And also, I mean, after he, let's not pull punches here, murders his wife and her lover, he comes out and before he shoots himself, there's that little weird smile that he gives the room. It's, I mean, that's just like a, whoa.
Well,
moment.
It's almost like a revenge suicide. It's like saying,
oh, it is.
I'm through with this. I'm through with all of you. This is
it's,
what
it's,
you
a, it's the smile of a broken man. I mean, I'm not saying otherwise, but well, it is, yeah. You know, a man who's also broken other people.
He said, the party's over, folks. The party's over. We're having a great time in the 70s, but the 80s is just around the corner and it ain't going to be as much fun, let me tell you.
Well, everything happens in that scene. I mean, you call it a scene, but it's a sequence. And so much so. On that night,
it's about 8 minutes or something.
Yeah, Todd, is it Todd Parker? Thomas Jane's character.
Yeah.
He shows up and then he introduces, and so he's, if there is an antagonist to this film, I think it's probably Todd, because he's the one who sends Dirk down the wrong path. Dirk, formerly Eddie.
Yeah, that's fair.
Amber introduces Dirk, I think, that night to cocaine. Mm-hmm. And then everything later goes wrong and he becomes a complete cocaine fiend. But also at that party, yeah, little Bill kills his wife and, well, let's not say lover, but sexual friend, and then himself. And then also at the same party is when Floyd Gondoli, I think, shows up and tells Jack Horner that the future of filmmaking is video.
Yeah. It's funny, the casting for this film almost kind of blows my mind. Like, can you imagine this film with Leo as the lead? Like, I don't see this film working in that way.
Tolstoy.
Yes, indeed. If Tolstoy had played Dirk Diggler, it would have been a very different film. Because, like, I can't imagine DiCaprio in the role. Like, it's a very different film if DiCaprio is Dirk Diggler. Because, you know, Anderson has seen him in What's Eating Gilbert Grape, and he asked him to do the role. He was committed to Titanic, couldn't do it, and he recommended Wahlberg for the role.
Yeah.
And has since said, and it's wild to think about it, like, he wishes he'd been able to do both. He doesn't obviously regret doing Titanic, but he said, like, one of the biggest regrets of his career was passing on Boogie Nights. But I can't see this film with Leo in that role. He doesn't have the right look for it. I don't think he has the right vibe, because Wahlberg, there's a real edge to him. And don't get me wrong, like, Leo has, certainly as he's become an older actress, he's matured as a player. I think he has an edge to him. But certainly at that age he was then, he's far too cherubic and baby-faced. Whereas I think, exactly what Alex talked about, that transition from Eddie to Dirk, which happens in this, like, Wahlberg completely inhabits that. And he is unsettling and he is obnoxious and on the edge and coked off his face.
And an idiot as well.
And a complete idiot. But he arrives fully formed in that role. Like, it's not hard to see why this film made him a massive star. It isn't at all.
He's a very underrated actor, is Mark Wahlberg, and he's absolutely terrific in this film. But, you know, he's surrounded by the most extraordinary cast. You know, I mean, we've mentioned a lot of them already, but William H. Macy, Heather Graham, this is the film I think that brought her to a lot of people's attention. I mean, she'd been in stuff beforehand, of course. Julianne Moore, Philip Seymour Hoffman.
This was a real step up for Julianne Moore as well.
Yeah. John C. Reilly, Don Cheadle, and of course, Burt Reynolds, who, in my opinion, should have won the Oscar that year and did not.
Well, maybe because he kept slagging it off.
That, I mean, yes, that was not the greatest strategy.
Well, he's denied that since, hasn't he? He's like, because PGA famously didn't get on while making the film. It's an incredible performance.
He's incredible. He's brilliant. Warren Beatty was in talks before that went in a different direction. But no, Burt Reynolds is absolutely fantastic in this film. He's got so much heart. And you never once do you, even on paper, what he does is, and how he does it, you know, he's watching young people, you know, the scene where he has Eddie have sex with Roller Girl for the first time, and he's just sitting there on the couch, absorbing it. And there's so much in this film that I think in the hands of a different director and a different cast, especially Burt Reynolds, could come across as sleazy. But it never really does.
I mean, it is sleazy.
Well, it is
sleazy
in subject matter.
But you don't feel like, oh, Jack Horner, what a sleazeball, because...
He's serious about his work.
Yeah, like, you never feel like he's getting them to do it because he's getting off on it. There's an element of, like, detachment to it. But then this whole film, to me, like, it's about porn, but it doesn't feel particularly salacious. Like, it's actually, and there's actually not that much nudity in it, given the type of film that it is. And it never feels exploitative and it never feels prurient. It feels almost, and I think this is, I guess, what porn is for people who work in the industry. It feels humdrum. It feels like a job. It feels like, you know,
although with Jack Horner, it's art.
Indeed, yeah. It's art for him. But I think that's very much to the film's credit, because it could have gone in a very different direction.
Mm. Because this film really put PTA on the map. Yes, Hard Eight had marked him out as someone to watch. But this, for me, I still remember where I was when I saw Boogie Nights for the first time. Not down to the postcode, but I remember being in Northern Ireland watching it for the first time and kind of being blown away by it. Because, yes, it is very Scorsese-influenced and, there's maybe a little bit of Tarantino in there as well, but I was so stunned by how bold and confident he was with, you know, his sense of time and place, establishing that, the sense of establishing an era, but also just some of the camera moves. You know, it's a bravura performance behind the camera for PTA. And it's interesting that, you know, the way he's evolved over the years, I mean, there's still a lot of really, really wonderful, very cinematic sequences, but maybe Magnolia aside, I think he evolved away from that after Boogie Nights.
I think there's, you know, there's an element of the same kind of showiness or show-offiness of a young director trying to make his name. I mean, you see the same thing with Spielberg and Jaws, right? Some of the slightly more complicated shots in Jaws. You know, when you think about that first real party scene where there's the cameras going into the water and following them as they swim underwater and then coming back up and seeing somebody jump off the diving board and then going back down. That kind of thing is a bit showy.
That was also a ripoff. That shot was a homage to a shot, and I mean, I know this, but I haven't seen the film, but I Am Cuba.
Oh, Soy Cuba, yeah.
It's the same shot. Homage. And there's a lot of homage in this film, but he does it so well that he owns it.
Well, this is what I'm saying. Yeah, it works really, really well in this film, but I think, you know, he wanted to show he wasn't just show-offy as he went along, and he could do classical and still get the same effect. And I think that's, again, it's the same path that, you know, Scorsese's and Spielberg's and all the rest have also taken. They have the toolbox. They can use the fancy schmancy shots when they want to, but they don't need that to get the impact. But I think it's used brilliantly here, and I think it's particularly in those party scenes throughout the film where you go from, you know, him as the kind of Alice in Wonderland being introduced to this world and you getting a sense of these characters for the first time in that first party. And then he's on top of the world. And then there's the sort of point where it all starts to go wrong. And then there's an echo actually at the end of the film where it's not quite a party, but they're getting back to it. You know, Dirk's back in business. Amber's back performing. Jack is directing once again. They're setting up the cameras, you know, and it's, and the Boots. the cameras following Jack through the house in that final scene, in much the same way it followed people through the parties before. So there's kind of an echo, there's kind of a sense of it
that's
continuing.
I felt that the end of it is a little bit more tawdry than that, and it's a darker time. AIDS is on the cusp of decimating the porn industry. It's going to be a specter in all these people's lives.
Obviously, this was partly inspired by the story of John Holmes, who was HIV positive by the end of his career. So,
and that end with you know, the iconic ending, you know, with Dirk revealing his full digderosity. That's a tremendously sad ending for me. It's iconic, but it's tremendously sad.
And yeah, look, I'm not saying everything is super duper happy in that final shot. What I'm saying is it's an echo of the way that the earlier ones have been
shot. And you feel the redemption as well there, because it feels like he's come full circle, like he's hit rock bottom, but he's managed to get back on top again.
And he's like, he's at least in the position to try again. Yeah. I agree with you. I don't think everything's going to be hunky-dory for him from now on, and I don't think he's ever going to sort of hit those heights again. But I do think that there's a sense of continuation and some kind of hope. That,
yeah, I agree.
You know, they can. These crazy kids can work something.
Well, that's
out.
The thing. It's about all of them, isn't it? Because this, I mean, as I'm sure we'll go on to talk about, this film is about family, as are some of PTA's other films. And, you know, this is about a found family and people from broken families, or people whose families have broken away from them. And it's this big gang of people who only find love and respect, even, and admiration
in each other.
In each other, in this very specific environment. Yeah. And then it fractures, and everyone has their problems, and, you know, those who are left all come together in the end. And it's almost like, and that's nice and hopeful, positive, but it's also almost because it's like they got nowhere else to go.
Yeah.
Which is quite sad.
Yeah. Mm. So Daddy Jack and Mama Amber have to really take them back in.
Yeah.
I don't know how the Freudians feel about this film, but they must feel some strong feelings.
I mean, talking about Mummy Amber, who's a mummy to a child who is kind of estranged from her and is trying to reach out to her, but she's just doing cocaine. And then she's phoning him when she's on cocaine. And there's a line at some point where Jack says to Dirk or Eddie at that point, you know, she's the best mother. She's a mother to everyone who needs love. Well, in some ways, yes. In some ways, no.
Mm.
Yeah. And obviously, Jack's an incredible father figure in this film.
It's absolutely heartbreaking when somebody calls the house during a party looking for Maggie. Yeah. No one can find Maggie because no one knows that's Amber. Mm. And she's sitting upstairs heartbroken that she doesn't have access to her son. You know, it's just awful.
The amount of tragedy in this film is so heavy, but you don't leave thinking, well, that was depressing.
No, you don't.
It's so joyful and inspiring at the same time.
Yeah. It's also quite propulsive for a 2.5 hour film as well. Like, it never sags at any point.
No.
And obviously, with the exception of, I want to say, Punch Drunk Love, PTA obviously likes his lengthy run times. Mm-hmm. He doesn't normally do punchy stories, but it does have momentum to it.
Yeah.
Yeah, it does.
It never stops.
Do you remember when you first saw it?
Yes.
I mean, I was in a cinema, but I remember being hyped for it. I think, you know, by this point, I was reading Empire religiously. I wasn't working
good
at Empire.
Good magazine. I recommend.
So I've heard.
But you know, there were articles about it, and I hadn't seen Hard Eight. I didn't for many years afterwards, but I was excited for this. I heard this was going to be a big thing to look out for. So I was kind of hyped going into the cinema. It was also, you know, a bit more grown up than many of the films I saw or still see.
Porn.
So that was a bit of an eye opener at times.
Yeah.
I remember actually being more explicit than it is when I watched
it again. Same here. And I wonder whether that's our taste or cinema as it's moved on, that, like, because the full frontal revelation, the unfurling, as it were, in the final scene, like, I remember being like gobsmacked by that in the cinema, whereas now, you know, perhaps it's because the other films I've watched this week perhaps have more explicit stuff in it. But yeah, it didn't shock me in the same way. And I had that feeling, oh, this is a very explicit film. And it isn't at all. It's actually very, very restrained.
It's not explicit, but there is full frontal nudity in there. There are porn scenes being filmed. A lot of it is more suggestive than
yeah.
might yeah, it's be people, effective. It's people reacting to his big shiny talents rather than showing
done?
That for the most part.
In his first scene with Amber, where you just see everyone, and it's so subtle. It's just a raised eyebrow, a little widening of the eyes, and they're like, oh my.
Widening of the lens, and
a couple of them like turn their heads sideways, and it's just, it doesn't make a meal out of it, no pun intended.
It's beautiful.
But it's done very well.
And the way Philip Seymour Hoffman reacts to it is just sort of quivering, just standing there quivering to himself, sweating.
Yeah, it's extraordinary.
Philip Again, Seymour Hoffman. Much like podcasting.
Just a note on, we keep mentioning Philip Seymour Hoffman and all the cast, but this film, I think, is the perfect example of, you know, they say there's no such thing as a small role. Philip Seymour Hoffman is not in this film a lot.
In it.
And he doesn't, and when he is in it, he doesn't do much. It's just everyone from him to the smallest roles, Melora Walters, you know, even William Macy, Don Cheadle, they don't have massive roles in Louis Guzman, but everyone is so fully fleshed out as a character and so fully fleshed out as a performance. You get the sense that every single person you're watching has a full life, and you could watch a film about them. Mm. And you can't say that about most films.
No, that is one of the things that I think makes this as special as it is. I personally prefer, you know, tragic, heartbroken Philip Seymour Hoffman. I prefer him in, say, Magnolia.
Yeah.
But this is, there's no arguing with his performance. You know, he's incredible in this.
It's very sad.
Yeah.
Very, very sad indeed. Did you detect in PTA back then the director he would go on to become? I mean, Magnolia was just, what, 2 years later? This is extraordinary, epic.
It's interesting, because for me, Boogie Nights and Magnolia go hand in hand. Mm. They're clearly the work of the same guy. It's a lot of the same cast and some of the same vibe, but also it's a massive leap in terms of emotion, you know, and there's something a lot more operatic about Magnolia, and it cuts really, really deeply. Boogie Nights, it's one of my favorite films. I absolutely love it. But it's not actually the most... It's not like an emotional workout, even though you do feel a lot of things while watching it. In the same way you watch Magnolia and you can cry your eyes out more than once.
Oh, yeah.
But yeah, it's interesting because I think as accomplished as this film is and perfect as it is, I feel like it's someone who is still clearly indebted to his influences and is still finding his feet as a filmmaker. I don't think you could watch that and know that There Will Be Blood would be coming, you know, 10 years later.
He completely reinvents himself.
Absolutely.
It's absolutely wild.
Yeah.
I probably loved Magnolia, I don't know about more than Boogie Nights, but it really, I remember really, really falling for it. I bought the soundtrack immediately, which weirdly I didn't with Boogie Nights, which is bizarre because it's a banger of a soundtrack.
Yeah, it is.
Mm. But I just found, I think it was the emotional aspect of that really kind of sunk its teeth into me. And yeah, there's continuity between the two films. There's obviously a few key cast members shared between them.
Quiz Kid Donnie Smith.
Quiz Kid Donnie Smith. But I think it is the emotion. It is the kind of heartbreak of Magnolia that really sticks with me. And also, like, just thinking about it and watching it again this week, you know, the Tom Cruise character was so ahead of his time. I mean, you know, he'd be absolutely raking it in. You talk about podcasters.
Yeah.
He'd be raking it in right now. He'd be Joe Rogan huge. He'd
respect
be just,
the pod.
Yeah.
Yeah. But how interesting that he, you know, identified that kind of archetype at that point before it was really taking over the world.
And it makes you feel for him.
Yeah.
And it makes you feel for him. Oh, which I hate.
Cruise is magnificent in that moment.
Yeah, he really is.
It really is. Such a great film. I love Magnolia so much. But you're absolutely right. The PTA we have now is a very different filmmaker than the PTA who made Boogie Nights. And that transformation, that reinvention started pretty quickly. Punch Drunk Love, for example, doesn't really have any of the slickness of Boogie Nights. And I think Punch Drunk Love was weirdly one of the movies in his filmography that kind of gets forgotten. I think people go from Magnolia to There Will Be Blood.
Yeah.
And they tend to skip the weird, twisted rom-com in the middle. Alex is looking at me as if he doesn't agree, but I think generally most people
I'm sure you're right. It's in my head, it's almost a trilogy, Boogie Nights and Magnolia and Punch Drunk Love, because it's like the San Fernando trilogy. Yeah. You know, they all have that same environment. That's where he comes from. That's where he still lives, I believe, or thereabouts. And that sort of landscape and the texture, you can feel that, no pun intended, you know, it's in his blood, those environments. And they're three very different films with very different tones, very different journeys. But they were made one after each other, one after another, and they feel like they come from the same. For me, it was after Punch Drunk Love that he started to become a very different filmmaker.
I think that begins in Punch Drunk Love already, but, you know, and there's...
Well, it's a constant evolution, isn't it?
Yeah, and obviously it's a step away from the ensemble to this is very much a protagonist-based filmmaking, which is where he went for, I would say, up until... And again, correct me if I'm wrong here, but I think up to Licorice Pizza, and even then, Licorice Pizza has clear leads in it. But he stepped away from that ensemble, that huge cast, to focus on Adam Sandler.
It's almost a Scotty J film, isn't it? I mean, in that it's another sad sack who, you know, hasn't quite figured things out and, you know, makes a pass at the wrong people or gets involved with the wrong people and you know, has to kind of try and figure out a way to extract himself. It doesn't not feel...
It's like amazing. Was it PTA? And correct me if I'm wrong. Chris, you would know.
Yeah.
He was the first director to harness Sandler's talent in a way that wins. And it was because he was an unashamed fan of his films. And there was no irony. He loved his films in the way that you do, Chris.
Yes.
He absolutely loved Adam Sandler films. But he also knew that there was more to him than had been presented to the world.
Yes.
And he launched what I would say is the second phase of Adam Sandler's career.
Yeah, I agree 100%. Entirely. And I think it's this incredible eye for talent that he has. If you know, because if going back to, you know, Mark Wahlberg, yeah, yes, his recommendation from Leo DiCaprio, but he sees in Mark Wahlberg Dirk Diggler. He sees that he has the ability to do that, where I think a lot of directors would have overlooked that, you know this kind of good-looking lunk of a man. And he has this ability to spy talent in people, and even talent that has kind of faded a little bit. Like, no one was casting Burt Reynolds by the time of Boogie Nights. Punch Drunk Love's really interesting because it is... It's almost like a dark riff on the Sandler movies of the time.
Yeah. Yeah.
He was playing people who had rage issues constantly, and Barry in that movie is just a rage monster. And yet, again, going back to Frank T.J. Mackey, he makes you feel something for him. And that love story between Sandler and Emily Watson in that film is really, really beautiful at times.
But it feels very contained, that film does. I always think it's almost like an answer to Magnolia, because I think the idea when he did Magnolia is he said, I'm going to make a more intimate, more personal, smaller film, and then obviously it spiraled into something which is anything but. And he was like, no, right, this time I'm absolutely going to do it, and I'm going to keep it to 90 minutes, and it's going to be really smart. And he actually managed to do it, and then of course went and did There Will Be Blood. But you know, it is that, and it's a very simple story at its heart, and it's very clear story, because a lot of his stories have so many moving parts, and this one I think is quite a pure little film.
It is,
yeah,
and it is weird. I mean, he is a rage monster, but he's also like a good guy. Those shouldn't really coincide in the way that they do, but it works. It works for this movie.
Yeah, a good guy surrounded by his seven sisters. I mean, that scene where they're all together,
God, they're so mean.
It's hilarious. And also what he does do with Sandler's rage. Chris, I'm not a massive connoisseur of the Sandler comedies, but yes, as you're saying, he's very angry in a lot of the films.
Yeah,
but what PTA does with that anger in this film is, it seems to me, that probably a lot more elemental, you know, and quite scary. That scene, let me just say, that scene, he goes on a date with her,
yeah,
and then he goes into the bathroom
to
have a little rage attack.
Yeah.
And I don't know what they do with the sound design, but it's almost like it sounds almost like he's smashing the microphones up. It's like really abrasive, really horrible.
Well, he was the first person to look at Sandler's rage issues in movies and go, why is this happening?
Yeah.
Why is this guy feeling this way? Whereas previously it was just a guy yelling at things.
Yeah.
But I love Punch Drunk Love. But I would argue that it is overlooked. I think certainly when people think about the masterpieces of PTA's career, they go Boogie Nights, they go Magnolia, they go There Will Be Blood, they go One Battle After Another, and then your mileage may vary on Phantom Thread. But I think those are the ones that people will pick out.
And
then, you know, he took 5 years off after Punch Drunk Love and then came back with There Will Be Blood. And it's just like a big old slap to the face. It's like being hit in the head with a bowling pin. If anyone can imagine that, can you imagine what that might feel like?
I am sure there are film academics who would tell me that I'm wrong, but I watched that. I can't see any trace of former PTA in There Will Be Blood at all.
Mm.
No.
I can't see it.
I don't see it in that. I don't see it in The Master. Maybe a little bit of an Inherent Vice, but I don't see it in those two films. Those two films, for me, are the darkest of his career by some distance.
It's interesting. I think more than anything else, One Battle After Another has that you can see everything was leading up to it.
You can see everything.
You can see his whole career in that film. And I remember when Licorice Pizza was coming out, and we knew it was going to be a softer film, a less operatic, less epic. I mean, it still is to some degree. I mean, it's a pretty crazy journey that they go on.
And has still, for me, one of the most exhilarating, terrifying sequences of his entire career when they're reversing back down the hill and your heart's in your mouth and Bradley Cooper's being terrifying as John Peters.
Yes.
It's so good.
But that film, I genuinely, like, in many ways, that is the most PTA film of all of the films because it's got so much of him in it. It's all his friends and family and his friends' family. And it's such a personal tale of his youth. I mean, obviously, a lot of the plot points are anecdotal from his friend, but you feel the man in that so much, and that kind of woozy, nostalgic look at that period of time in the 70s. I actually, there's something about that film that it really stands out for me among the other films that he's made.
It's a very sweet film. What is interesting is, although it was returning to, you know, stories from his youth, and he was filming it in San Fernando Valley again.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
That all, and I heard that John C. Reilly was going to be in it. I mean, he barely is. I mean, do you even see him? I think you hear him.
Yeah, he's in one scene as Herman Munster, isn't he? As the guy who played.
Yeah, exactly. So it's almost like giving my friend a cameo.
Yeah.
But, and Philip Seymour Hoffman, who was a mainstay of PTA films for a few years, and now his son is the lead in this film.
Yeah.
So all of this made me think, oh, wow, we're going to get a film that's going to feel like that San Fernando Valley era from the late 90s. And it's just not, even though it's getting into very similar terrain, sort of thematically and, you know, geographically, it doesn't feel anything like those films. And it's because he's not the same filmmaker anymore. And he can revisit some of that territory. But he's an older guy now with kids, with a completely different set of filmmaking tools.
Mm.
And so it's interesting, he goes back to it, you know, 20 years later, but it just doesn't feel like the same guy at all because he's not the same guy anymore.
Mm. Well, because he had done these very kind of much more formalist, I guess, films in There Will Be Blood, The Master, and Phantom Thread, I would argue as well. They're very, you know, very kind of looking back to almost classic Hollywood. The shots are so incredibly composed. You know, he's experimenting with film formats. He is obviously working with some of the greatest actors in the world, Philip Seymour Hoffman in The Master, but also, you know, obviously Daniel Day-Lewis. It's just kind of operating on a slightly different level. And it's not to say the first level was wrong or bad or less good even, but just that he's just trying something new. He's giving himself new challenges all the time. He's pushing in different directions.
Well, There Will Be Blood, the fact that it's entirely dialogue-free for what, the first 15, 16 minutes is wild to me.
Yeah.
Like, as a sort of statement of confidence in a film that's very different from anything he'd done up until that point.
Yeah. Absolutely. Again, going back to the idea that he can spot raw talent, I mean, nobody had really believed in Daniel Day-Lewis until that point. They didn't really know. They looked at him and thought, he's okay, he's handsome.
I mean, he's fine. He's no Adam Sandler.
Yeah, can he act? I'm not so sure he can act. And then PTA went, you know what? I believe in you.
Yeah.
Wow.
There you go.
It must be to be believed in like that.
But do you remember where you were when you first saw There Will Be Blood and it just slaps you around the face?
Drinking milkshakes.
Yeah, you've got to feel bad if you got a milkshake on the way into the cinema for that one, don't you? My God.
Well, he'd drink it, you know.
Well, he would, yeah.
You'd have drunk it by that point, in fairness.
It is incredible. I remember it becoming, you know, it just became, you know, the year of the Western, essentially, almost, you know, at least half on the strength of that one film. But it just felt like, oh, we're bringing something back here. Like, this is a whole new way of examining the West. This is a whole new way of examining American history. In a way that I guess he's continued to do with like one battle after another. Mm. And that to a degree, you know, it's been there and it was definitely present in Boogie Nights as well. There's you can absolutely read that as a critique of capitalism and everything else, right? Mm-hmm. In the same way that There Will Be Blood is. I think it's an astonishingly powerful film, incredible score as well. And mm-hmm. And yeah, a pretty good performance from Daniel Day-Lewis.
It is one of his best, no question, right? It's just absolutely... You can't keep your eyes on it. It is genuinely one of the most iconic performances in cinema, I think. He's incredible in it.
Yeah.
Look at his face.
I mean, at the very end as well. Like, that whole scene in the bowling alley is extraordinary.
Yeah. I saw There Will Be Blood in the Roundhouse some years back with a live orchestra. It was a live score version with Johnny Greenwood there.
Ooh. Really?
Really, really worked. Because, I mean, that is an all-timer, that soundtrack. Mm.
Wow.
That's a soundtrack I bought as well. It's incredible.
Yeah. I mean, it's interesting, I think, to talk about his evolving and ongoing partnership with Johnny Greenwood because it's, you know, his first...
That's where it starts.
I mean, there were lots of needle drops going on in his first few films. I mean, obviously, there was some score as well. I mean, Boogie Nights has a couple of bits of score in it, but Magnolia...
I like John Bryan's score for
Magnolia.
Punch Drunk Love. And Magnolia, but Punch Drunk Love as well.
Yeah. Magnolia was John Bryan's score and Amy Mann songs. Yeah. And then,
Boogie Nights is all of the music. Yeah, I mean, just like, it is an insane number of needle drops.
It can convert. I mean, I did not love disco, and I don't still love disco, but I love a lot of disco because of that film.
Disco is not dead. Disco is life.
But so he started making, you know, his collaboration with Johnny Green was started with There Will Be Blood, and I don't know, they're just one of the best director-composer partnerships in film. One Battle After Another's score is amazing.
Mm-hmm.
And now it's like you can't imagine them without each other.
We talked a lot, obviously, already about the great cast he's worked with and some of the great characters that he has created in his career. Is Daniel Plainview the character of PTA's career? Is it the character of Daniel Day-Lewis's career? I mean, he's a terrible, terrible monster, and I wouldn't like to spend even 30 seconds in his company, especially if he had a bowling pin in his hand. But he is just so compelling.
Mm.
The only reason I would say he isn't the character of PTA's career is that he feels like a bit of an outlier because he's such a monster.
Yeah.
And you know, so he's not typical. He doesn't represent the sort of the mean or the average PTA character for me because I think there is so much heart and humor and lightness to his films. Like, I wouldn't argue with you if you said Dirk Diggler, actually, because I feel like there's something...
Or Quiz Kid Donny Smith.
Oh, yeah.
Sorry, I just love Quiz Kid Donny Smith.
But, you know, this is not to say that darkness isn't a part of these movies. It absolutely has been. And Frank is nearly as much a monster as Daniel Plainview, for example, in Magnolia.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
But I just feel like he's not as dark as that. And that's why he wouldn't represent PTA for me. Yeah. If is he the best single character he's created? I mean, maybe.
I don't know. I think Reynolds Woodcock is an extraordinary character because there's a subtlety to that which I think is absent in Daniel Plainview because it is all about control and repression and to a certain extent abuse, but also kind of self-loathing. There's so much going on because it's a very, like, you compare it to There Will Be Blood, which is this broad canvas, big events, huge things happening, and it's so contained. Phantom Thread is like it has a very, I was going to say it's well woven. I'm not sure that Woodcock would approve of that, but it's a beautifully tailored movie. Yes, is what I'm saying.
I think you could say that Daniel Day-Lewis has played Paul Thomas Anderson's best bastards.
Yeah,
the master.
He's also not a great person.
He's a master bastard.
Yeah. Well, I think if I were to pick a single actor who I associate with Paul Thomas Anderson, it might still be Philip Seymour Hoffman.
Yeah.
Because I feel like, you know, Boogie Nights was such a massive step up for him, even though it's a tiny role, but it just was one of the films that really got him noticed, I feel like. And then the sheer breadth of what he showed in Magnolia and The Master, I just think it you know, he gave him some of the best roles of his incredible career.
Mm. He's funny in Punch Drunk Love as well.
Yeah, he is actually. Yep. Yeah, you're right.
And was it, I think it was in Hard Eight as well. I think it was
more... And you feel him in Licorice Pizza, even through Cooper, like, because they are very similar.
Yeah. I mean, well, I think they certainly did four or five films together. And yeah, and it was an absolute tragedy of not having more. He'd still be making films with him, I think.
I think so too.
Yeah, he'd have been in one battle after another. He'd probably have been in Licorice Pizza somehow. I don't know how, but that would have been interesting. Mm. Yeah. All right, well, listen, it's nearly time to bring this bad boy to an end. Is there anything else you would like to say about Mr. Paul Thomas Anderson or Boogie Nights that hasn't been said? I called him earlier on one of the great American filmmakers of the last 25 years, and perhaps the greatest American filmmaker of the last 25 years. Where do you stand on that statement?
It's hard to argue with it, isn't it? I mean, the proof is in the pudding. There's lots of puddings in Punch Drunk Love.
So many puddings.
The proof is in the milkshake.
I don't know if I'd call him the, mostly because I don't rank anybody that way, but definitely among the greatest. I don't like to. But I do think he's up there.
Yeah. Well, he's an auteur. Like, he has a very distinctive filmmaking voice. There's no one else making films quite like him.
I would say, I think what you can say is that he brings the absolute best out of anyone who appears in his films. And, you know, people want to work with him because he's an amazing actor's director. I mean, I don't know what he's like on sets, but he writes the most incredible roles and he gets the most incredible performances out of people. This is why the actors are lining up to work with him. I mean, I've said it before, but every single character in Boogie Nights, right down to the smallest one, is amazing or heartbreaking or sad or hilarious or ridiculous. All of them. I love all of them.
He's incredible. I've interviewed him a number of times. You've interviewed him a number of times. No, Alex, Helen, you have as well. Jimbo, had the pleasure?
I've never met him personally.
Never met him. No. Obviously an incredibly, massively intelligent person, but he's a broad church. He's got incredibly wide-ranging tastes, and he's talked to us about how he loves silly parody comedies, and you know, he's obviously a big fan of, you know, Where Adam Sandler Came From on Saturday Night Live, for example, and all of that, all is like, you know, it's like this big melting pot of influences.
Pornography.
In his film. Who doesn't love pornography? Pornography and podcasts.
But just I guess he's a very technically efficient film. It's fascinating to me how technical his films are, given that he's a man who famously didn't go to film school and learned everything from watching movies. Like, he's a fan first and foremost. And like, you see his incredible sort of like his camera work, the kind of the long takes that he does, and all of kind of the sort of flourish that he puts into these films. Mm. And all of it is just through observation.
Yeah. Do you know, talking about he didn't go to film school, I believe, so the story goes, he did
2 days.
Goes to film school. Is it one or two days?
Yeah,
one
he day? Spent 2 days in film school and was like, nope, not for me.
Well, because the teacher said, if anyone here wants to learn how to write Terminator 2, get out. And he was like, see you later. Because I love Terminator 2. True story, apparently.
Yeah. That's amazing.
He's his own guy. Yeah. And I think, you know, many of the best filmmakers since literally the French New Wave have been the guys who just loved film, watched it obsessively, and taught themselves how to do it. And he has grown up steeped in film culture. You know, he was very much around it from a young age and clearly knows it in his bones, like the best of them.
Very much so. It's interesting that he hasn't written a Terminator 2-esque movie since, or maybe he's
that
on loads
we know of.
That we know
maybe
of.
Maybe his next film.
He's never been a director for hire, but he has been a script doctor on some very high-level films recently by some of his friends. But, he could probably do anything, but he only wants to do stuff. He only wants to do what he wants to do. And, he's got 100% integrity.
Yeah, but that's it, isn't it? He's not doing anything because he's asked to do it. You get them. These are the stories that he wants to tell, and you feel there's a bit of him in all of them. Like, this is his very distinct voice.
Yeah, absolutely. They're all personal, I think, in completely different ways.
Yeah.
Has anyone got him and the other directing Paul Anderson together? Because I think that could be a great combo.
No.
I think we should do it.
Event Horizon Vice.
I was there when Brian Cox met Brian Cox for the first time. You may even say I made it happen. So I think this is going to be my new life goal. I'm going to get Paul W.S. Anderson and Paul Thomas Anderson together.
To discuss or something, or to make a film together?
To make the greatest movie ever made, Alex.
What would be this film?
I don't know.
One Paul Anderson after another.
Yes. amazing stuff. And on that note, I think that is it for this very, very special podcast in association with Warner Brothers, of course, to discuss the work of the wonderful Paul Thomas Anderson. Boogie Nights is out right now, folks. It has been remastered in 4K for the first time, so now is a perfect time to revisit this legendary classic. Visit Warner Bros, and that's B-R-O-S, warnerbros.co.uk for more details. But in the meantime, all that remains for me is to say goodbye to my three big, bright, shining colleagues of such lethal cunning. Goodbye, Helen Digler.
Oh, no. Bye-bye.
Goodbye, Alex, who for some reason is just swaying in a dressing gown at the moment, throwing firecrackers at the ground. I don't really know what's going on.
This is a real film, Jack.
It's goodbye from James Dyer, who is enjoying a plate of mushrooms. You enjoying them, Jim?
Yes, funnily enough, some soup. Not a milkshake, crucially.
No. Not a milkshake. And it's goodbye from me. I've abandoned my pod! I'm finished. Thanks for listening. See you next time. Bye-bye.